Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason filling in for Dave Ross. 100 days into the Biden administration with one party in charge in the White House and both houses of Congress. So what has been accomplished so far? Let's bring in Congressman Derek Kilmer, who represents our state's 6th district. Hello, Congressman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
So when we hear about these big multi-trillion dollar proposals, the jobs plan, the families plan, my question is always, well, what's in it for us?
Yeah, let's take one at a time, perhaps. You know, obviously the initial proposal was the jobs plan. And we know that, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, that American infrastructure grades out at C-. We've certainly seen that in our region as we sit in traffic far too much. I think sometimes the speed limit signs on Interstate 5 are only there for nostalgic purposes. You know, we know that in my neck of the woods, where we have, you know, areas that don't have access to high-speed internet. I mean, during this pandemic, we've learned that access to high-speed internet is not just about whether you can watch season 3 of Cobra Kai on Netflix,
right.
Which you should because it was terrific.
It's
but
a great show.
It's also about, you know, whether your kid can keep learning if school's gone remote and if you can keep running a business if your storefront's shut down. And for far too many of the folks I represent, the answer to that is they can't.
Mm-hmm.
We know even before this pandemic that we had issues related to housing affordability. We saw in Texas a great example of the need to modernize our electrical grid. So I think the American Jobs Plan is really about not just putting people to work now, but about laying the foundation for our economic growth over the long haul.
So I said in the introduction, Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. But it seems like these negotiations for these things drag on and take forever. What is the issue there?
So part of the issue is just how procedures work in Washington, D.C. I mean, even when all the stars are aligned, Congress is not always a legislative juggernaut. Made more complicated by the fact that the rules of the Senate and the rules particularly associated with the filibuster allow things to be held up even if there's a majority support. So that's been the issue with some of the things that have passed out of the House, for example. We've, you know, actually seen pass out of the House legislation like the Equality Act, which does something the state of Washington has already done, and that is to expand non-discrimination protections to the LGBTQ community. You know, that's something that, you know, should be the law all across our country to make sure that people can't be denied housing or denied employment based on who they are or who they love. And, you know, that is a bill that passed out of the House. It had some bipartisan support, and I hope it can pass the Senate, but it faces a higher hurdle because it has to get 60 votes under the filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of things like the American Families Plan and the American Jobs Plan, it may take a little while putting together a significant, really the first significant infrastructure package in more than a generation. You know, that is complicated stuff and will require some negotiation. The tagline I've heard has been infrastructure by Independence Day. And if this can get done by the summer, I think that would be an extraordinary success because it could get people working and start fixing some of these problems that need fixing.
Yeah, and green jobs, I know, is a big part of that. And this administration has some dedicated climate specialists and for the first time in a few years, people who seem to actually care about the environment. You represent a very green part of the country, both figuratively and literally. So what are your goals? What are your environmental goals?
I represent coastal communities. I represent 4 coastal tribes that, as you and I are speaking, are in the process of trying to move to higher ground because of persistent flooding and more severe storms, not to mention the threat of tsunami. You know, the largest employer in my district is the United States Navy, and it turns out our naval bases are on the water. And so they are very concerned about climate resilience as well, and not to mention the fact that the Department of Defense looks at climate change as a threat multiplier. And so stepping up to the climate crisis is a big priority for this administration and for me and for my constituents as well. I'll also mention as we think about environmental priorities, I serve on the Appropriations Committee and on the Interior and Environment Subcommittee. And there's a tremendous opportunity for us to work with this new administration on things like Puget Sound recovery, on salmon recovery, on orca protection. You know, these were things where, frankly, we were fighting from a defensive posture under the last administration. And I don't say this in a partisan way. It's just a statement of fact. The last administration, in every one of its budgets, proposed eliminating all federal funding for Puget Sound recovery. I do not think that cost should be solely borne by the taxpayers of the state of Washington. They proposed eliminating all federal funding for salmon recovery, not despite the fact that the federal government has treaty obligations and obligations under the Endangered Species Act. And so we have fought hard to make sure that we're not only not eliminating funding for those vital programs, but that we're increasing funding. And because of a whole lot of work, not just by me, but by people who care about these issues in our region, we've been successful in increasing those funds. But I can't tell you how excited I am to work with an administration that shares those priorities.
What about vaccines? Because we're in an area with some pretty high enthusiasm about vaccines. But what do your colleagues in less receptive parts of the country tell you?
I think by and large, at least my colleagues have been supportive of trying to get more shots into more arms more quickly. And I think that has been, again, a success of this administration because they've focused like a laser on it. You know, obviously, it is important that we have public health leaders who are speaking fact and, you know, talking about the importance of this, making sure that we're providing adequate access to the vaccines. You know, I think in early rollouts, you saw just from an availability standpoint, some challenges in communities of color. I think the Biden administration has done really important work so that we can put this virus in our rearview mirror. I think that's really important. I've talked to far too many of my constituents who've lost loved ones as a consequence of this pandemic. And when someone reaches out to your office saying, hey, you know, I lost my wife or I lost a family member or I lost my mom because of this pandemic, I'm not sending them a form letter. I'm calling them. And, right. And you know, they're really, you know, this is a virus that has really upended a whole lot of lives. And so I am really hopeful that we continue to make this progress on vaccination. We get more shots into more arms as quickly as possible. So hopefully we can save a whole bunch of lives. And hopefully we can see our economy get back to some semblance of normalcy.
Congressman Derek Kilmer, representing Washington's 6th District, thank you so much for talking to us.
You bet. Terrific being with you.
A massive overhaul of our state's drug policy is about to kick into high gear following the legislature's passage of a new drug possession law. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has more on what it's going to look like.
Yes, good morning, Arian.
Good morning.
So we've talked a lot about Blake this week and the decision that came out of the legislature, and I wanted to find out a little more about what that's going to look like moving forward. We know that the Blake Fix Bill, as they call it, makes minor possession of any drug is going to be a misdemeanor now. The bill would mandate that you have pre-arrest diversion, which means that you don't even get to a prosecutor the first couple of times. If you're caught by police, they have to send you, or refer you, I should say, to treatment, but you don't have to take them up on that. And then on the third go around, you would get to the prosecutor, who would then be also strongly encouraged to send you to treatment and divert you and keep you out of the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. This is a really big change for the state. And I want to point out too that the governor still has not signed this, it is assumed that he will. So then it'll sunset in 2 years, and they've got some funding and they've got this time to really build out this kind of statewide system. And it's going to be a huge, huge undertaking. And everyone involved admits that it's going to be chaotic at first, but most on all sides think in the long run it could really be a significant game changer in the state. Democratic State Representative Lauren Davis, she wrote part of the bill known as the Blake Fix and had early this session pushed another bill that would decriminalize small amounts of any drug. While this is not that, Davis is excited about what this bill requires statewide moving forward.
The hope is that we do offer continuous pathways to recovery, both from community, from emergency departments, homeless encampments, self-referral, family referral, to try to actually help people prior to coming into contact with the criminal legal system. And then even if they do, they've got not one, but two, there'll be two efforts to make sure that they are proactively connected to services. So the hope is that we'll capture the vast majority of people before that criminal legal system contact occurs.
Now, even when someone does get to that third instance, as I said, the prosecutor will finally have a look at that case and decide whether to charge a misdemeanor or to divert them to treatment. Snohomish County Prosecutor Adam Cornell, though, believes most prosecutors will opt to divert to treatment. If they don't,
if I were to take that approach, so on the first time I get a referral, to say, okay, you're going to get charged with simple possession, you're going to get charged with a misdemeanor, I'll tell you what's going to happen. Defense lawyer is going to say, okay, well, we're going to trial, and my office is going to have to submit the drugs to the state crime lab to have them test the drugs. Do you really think that the state patrol crime lab is going to be testing drugs for a misdemeanor prosecution?
So the State Patrol Crime Lab has been backed up for years with a variety of different kinds of lab testing that they have to do, whether it be on drugs or, you know, rape kits, all of that. So the answer is likely no. The lab will not be making testing the priority on a misdemeanor.
If the answer to that question is no, then where does a traditional prosecution go when in Snohomish County there's no defense lawyer worth their salt that's just going to plead their client out to a misdemeanor? With the understanding that probably the crime lab is never going to test the drugs. And if you can't test the drugs, you can't prove the crime.
Now, one of the other things he told me that was interesting is a big part of this bill is the creation of what are called recovery navigators. So each region, county, it'll kind of lay out differently in each local area, depending on, you know, geography, basically. They'll have these recovery navigators, which is kind of the person who's going to hold the person going to treatment's hand and help them really navigate this system and get everywhere that they need to go and do all the things that they need to do, all of that, kind of walk them through it. What we had before, one of the big reasons that it was so much pressure to have this bill, one of several big reasons, was they didn't want to have a piecemeal, right? We already had seen with no law in the books after that Supreme Court decision, places like Marysville, I think Lakewood and a couple of other jurisdictions go ahead and enact their own local ordinances, making it a gross misdemeanor, a tougher law, if you will, for someone to be caught with possession. With this bill, I asked, I go, what happens to those? And he said those are negated as soon as the governor signs this bill. But those jurisdictions would still be able to go ahead and reenact their own ordinances to have something tougher on the books. And there's really everyone behind this pleading with those jurisdictions not to do that because it would really upset that statewide effort, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, sure. The whole collective.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's a bit of a concern for the prosecutors and some others. Overall, though, the general idea here is to create a statewide lead program. That's the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, which has been up and running here in King County for years. And Director Lisa Dugard says they're going to have a seat at the table on the implementation of this. And there's also funding.
There's some funding, you know, not funding to do that at scale for every person who has problematic drug use in the state of Washington, but definitely enough funding to get started and begin to build, those channels in every corner of the state so that the potential of that becomes very evident and there's more and more community confidence, law enforcement confidence that that works. When you build those channels and they're real, people use them and it rapidly becomes clear that that makes so much more sense than arresting somebody, booking them into jail, sending them to court, only to be referred back to the same system.
Now, Representative Davis is most excited by the funding.
This bill represents the largest single investment in the substance use disorder continuum of care in state history by orders of magnitude. It is substantial and significant and really exciting because specifically, the investments are highly strategic. So the substance use disorder continuum of care has three segments. There's pre-treatment outreach services, so that's folks who are not currently connected to care. And then there's treatment services, which is inpatient, outpatient, medications for opioid use disorder. And then there's recovery support services, which is things like housing and employment that actually lead to sustained long-term recovery from this disease.
And she says, until now?
We have a system that funds precisely one leg of a three-legged stool. We fund treatment because we can bill Medicaid, and that's mostly billable to the federal government. So we will pay for your treatment over and over and over and over, but we will fail to fund the recovery support services that help people stay in recovery and preserve that investment in treatment and just keep paying for their treatment rather than fully investing in the continuum of care. And we've never done that before in the state. The state legislature has invested next to nothing in pre-treatment services and recovery support services ever. And the bill funnels tens of millions of dollars specifically to those parts of the continuum. And I think the results will be dramatic.
Now, she admits it's going to take some time, but if you listen closely and if you've watched much of what goes on here in our response to drug addiction, it's some of the most significant things I've heard as far as changing the direction of what we do that maybe leads to something different.
I think, we all can't agree on anything. I was going to say, I think we can all agree, but that's just not a phrase you can use these days. That what we've done, it hasn't worked, right? And so I like the idea that we're looking for new and better ways to handle this situation. What does the partisan bickering look like? Is there any of that? Do you feel confident that these measures will be implemented and given the chance to be tried?
I think that we'll definitely get the chance to be tried. I think it's going to be chaotic in the first couple of years. I want to make clear there is nowhere near enough funding in this. This legislature needs to step up significantly more in the coming years, and everyone agrees on that. But this is a way to get us started, and they're going to really kind of focus in. There's several counties that have grants for their own lead programs already. They're going to be better equipped to kind of get going on this, and everyone's just going to work together. A couple of things to point out. There's criticism from, you know, law enforcement because they have to deal with that first diversion. They're going to have to be up and trained, and not everyone is familiar with the lead model. I am confident. The pushback is that there's no way to compel someone to treatment. We'll have to see how that plays out. Most studies don't show that that works. One other thing, a lot of criticism about the LEAD program. You know, you look at Seattle and you go, how does the LEAD program helped at all? There's homeless and drug people everywhere. Never has LEAD been fully funded to scale in Seattle, and that's why it doesn't work the way it's supposed to here.
Right. Well said. Hannah Scott, Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you so much.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird and Company Incorporated. If you could have one wish, what would it be? The Make-A-Wish Foundation asked that question to a 5-year-old boy in Missouri who's been battling leukemia. And his wish was to help other kids in the hospital. CBS affiliate KTVI has the story.
This is Grayson. Macy's employees and shoppers funded his wish to give children in the hospital comfortable sheets so their time in the hospital is a bit easier.
It made me feel like I was at home.
The soft-spoken 5-year-old spent 20 days in the hospital fighting leukemia, so he knows a thing or two about how the children who receive his gift will feel.
Is it pretty special? Do you think they'll be excited?
I think they'll be excited.
Grayson's mom, Ann, says he is lucky, and she panicked at first when Make-A-Wish reached out, until she learned wishes are not just for terminal children.
He understands that this was a wish. It could be for him to ask for something. I think he also knows how important and how special it is to give back.
Macy's West County store manager says employees and customers jumped on board.
When I got the information about Grayson, I heard his story. It was absolutely something that we 100% wanted to be part of. So I'm super excited to be able to do this today, and such an amazing cause and such an amazing young man.
We have asked him a million times, and he's always maintained that this is what he wanted to do, and that he's proud of it, and he is happy.
Grayson is in remission and has a few weeks left of regular treatment. His family and the doctors all hope that he can ring that chemo bell a year from this November.
I love that story. That so story sweet. Is brought to us by Aaron Mason.
Oh,
he sent it to us yesterday.
Know,
he found it online.
I saw it. I mean, is there? There's just nothing. That's such a tearjerker.
I know.
To me, like, I really do well up at this beautiful little kid who could have done something for himself, could have met The Rock or whatever it is kids are doing these days, but said no. Like, I know what it's like, and I want to help the people around me. I mean, just God bless that kid. Seems like his parents are expecting treatment to end in a year, like to get through this, and everybody's looking up. So
yeah,
my best to that.
Hope he gets to
kid.
Ring the bell.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, ring the bell, indeed. Seattle's Morning News. Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross. Now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon. Right here on Cairo Radio, it is G. Scott. Good morning, G.
Hey, good morning, Mace.
How
good
you doing, man?
Oh,
you
I'm
sound
good, man.
You sound fired up,
man. Your boy on two cups. You know what I'm saying?
All right. I just tried to go get one because I've only had one, and our producer reminded me that you're back on the air in 30 seconds, you dummy. So
you know what I'm saying? I'm on two cups.
Good.
And so by the time my show starts. Now, those that will probably continue to listen, by the way, they get mad at me when I get up to like 4 and 5 cups before 9 o'clock because I get a little hyped up and everything.
You're like those guys. Remember in the cartoons where they run, but they run in place and they build up speed for a second and then off like a bullet.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. What are we talking about today, man?
Okay, so I know that you watched the president's address last
sure
night, and I know you watched the GOP rebuttal. Yeah. Do you want to listen to the first like 25 seconds
of
the
Senator
rebuttal?
Tim Scott?
Yes.
Please.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. This is what. Yes.
Here we go.
Good evening. I'm Senator Tim Scott from the great state of South Carolina. We just heard President Biden's first address to Congress. Our president seems like a good man.
Stop it right there.
Okay.
Stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Stop it. Just stop it right there. Like, I mean, come on. If you are trying to talk to the American people.
Yeah.
And we are talking about togetherness. And you are, in your speech, you're talking about how some of the policies that President Biden and, quote, the Democrats, I mean, it always seems like you're talking towards each side.
Mm-hmm.
But as you do that, you start your speech off with, he seems like a good man.
Seems like one.
I mean, that right there says a lot.
Yeah.
And I can continue to go on and on. I'll say this because I know everybody has their opinion about what Tim Scott. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about today on the G and Ursula show is this. He said, America is not a racist country. Mm. I woke up at 3:30 this morning. Couldn't go to sleep. This was weird. I don't know. I couldn't go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that because I'd had a buddy of mine text me and says, can you believe that that's what he said? He said America isn't a racist country. Gee, is America a racist country? And I never texted him back last night. Well, at 3:30 this morning, I was thinking about that question and I was really thinking about it. And I've come to the conclusion. No, I actually agree with Senator Tim Scott. Hear me out.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I don't believe that America is a racist country. There is too much diversity within this country. There's too many people that want to change the past of what things that happened yesterday. So an example would be this. Let's just say you have a few racists that work at a company.
Okay.
Does that mean it's a racist company?
No, not necessarily.
Now, I know, if there was a company where in the past they had systems in place that were racist,
right.
And you could say, hey, you know what? This company in the 50s was doing this, and redlining happened this,
mm-hmm.
and people weren't allowed in schools. Oh, you could go into all of that. You could talk about the past. But as far as 2021 and beyond, I am not comfortable saying, me personally, my feeling,
sure,
saying that America is a racist country.
Wow, that I'm surprised to hear that. I don't share the same opinion as you. I think to say that you know, this country isn't racist and you're the only black senator, Republican senator, that's, I think, something worth noting. And two, like, you made a great illustration of systematic racism. When people talk about systematic racism, you have a company or you have a country that, regardless of whether or not there are racist people in it, if you took all the people out and the system worked the way it is designed to work, would it still be racist? And I think there's a lot that still happens in areas of our country, specifically with, you know, criminal justice and things like that, that even if you took everybody out of it, the way it's designed to work is sort of inherently biased against race or informed by ideas of race.
No question about it. But again, at 3:30 this morning, I had to ask myself, right. I say, self, is America a racist country?
Uh-huh.
And for me, I say no. I don't. And here's why, another reason why I believe no. Because you know me, man. I'm a glass half full type of dude.
Very much so.
That's how I live my life. Is how I have, in my opinion, that's any success that I've had in life is because of that forward thinking, right? It's the way I raise my kids.
The way you survived, man.
It's the way I survived.
For sure.
Like I survived in this world. And I've gotten success in this world by believing that there is a possibility of a better tomorrow. I use that term all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way I would be able to sleep at night knowing that there is no possibility of a better tomorrow. And because I believe that, I can't be comfortable in saying that this is a racist country. Again, going back to my small point of, if there's a few racists that are working at a company, does that mean the company's racist? And or your one illustration example, you said, well, Senator Scott is the only black person on that side, right?
Mm-hmm.
If there's only one black person or if there's no black people working at a particular company, is that company racist, right? So you can't really put that on it, too. So if there's one thing, I'll give Tim Scott one thing I agreed with.
Uh-huh.
Was that? I agree, Tim Scott. And by the way, Senator Tim Scott, can you do me a favor? Can you change your last name?
I was going to say.
Please.
You're just agreeing because you guys are related somehow. Scott.
Don't do me like that.
That is G. Scott, everybody. always fun to talk to you, man. Really appreciate it. Stay tuned for the G and Ursula show at 9 o'clock, everybody, right here on Cairo Radio. 3 days. That's how long it took for the legal battle to begin over the just-passed capital gains tax. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is live with us with details. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Aaron. Yeah, so lawmakers passed the 7% tax on capital gains above $250,000 on Sunday. Yesterday, Max Nelson with the Conservative Freedom Foundation says they joined another team in filing the first lawsuit against what they call an illegal income tax.
We are representing a group of plaintiffs from around Washington State. The case was filed in Douglas County Superior Court, and we are arguing in short that the capital gains income tax proposal is unconstitutional both under the Washington State and the U.S. Constitutions.
Their arguments?
We make several arguments as to why the capital gains income tax violates both the Washington State and the United States Constitutions. The primary argument for Washington State is that our state constitution provides that taxes on property have to be uniform. And our state courts have repeatedly held over the years that income is property. And so any income tax that is imposed in Washington State needs to be uniform. And that's not what we see in Senate Bill 5096. It targets specifically higher earning individuals or capital gains of over a certain amount, and it is not uniformly applied. And so we believe it violates the uniformity requirement for property taxes in Washington State.
And specifically?
At the federal level, there's also a number of issues. Again, probably the biggest one is that it taxes sale of capital gains held outside Washington State if the sale is made by a Washington resident. And we believe that violates the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which limits the ability of states to pass legislation that has impacts across their own border.
Now, many wonder why they would even try this when the Democrats, that is, when the state Supreme Court has set clear precedent in the past. Doesn't the court have to follow that?
Of course, judges get to do what judges want to do. Certainly, they are supposed to abide by past precedent, but obviously from time to time they don't. So again, once you get into the courtroom, there's no guarantees as to the outcome, but the precedent on these matters is very strong. Now, it's also interesting to note that the legislature went out of its way to try and muddy the waters with this issue. The legislature called it an excise tax as opposed to a capital gains income tax. I don't think that makes a difference in the long run. It doesn't change the nature of the tax. You know, every other state in the union and the IRS have all recognized that a tax on capital gains is a tax on income.
Now, I have not heard directly from any of the sponsors of this bill, but House Majority Leader Pat Sullivan did issue a statement yesterday saying that as far as these lawsuits, they're welcome to make their case. We assume that this will make it to the state Supreme Court. It is the position of the legislature that this is an excise tax. To that, Nelson says,
the legislature can call it whatever it likes, but it doesn't change the nature of the tax as a tax on income. But clearly the legislature was trying to make this appear at least different from previous measures that have been struck down.
Now, while this was already filed in Douglas County, there's a second lawsuit on the way.
Hannah, people get fired up about this one.
Yes.
Yes, very, very, very passionate about it. What is the intended use of the tax, of that tax money?
This is going into the Fair Start for Kids program. This mm-hmm. is child care, early learning is the bulk of this. But then overall, the idea is to start the effort of balancing our state's tax code. But the group that's going to be filing the second lawsuit, they have some emails that they did some records requests on. I think it was Jason Mercier over at the Washington Policy Center who had done some public records requests a while back, and he got some emails from a state senator saying that the big deal why they want this capital gains tax passed is because they want it to go to court, and they want the court to revisit the decades-old decision where they said income was property, and that thereby making this an illegal income tax because everything had to be uniform if it's a property, right? So that's what the goal is of the legislature, and then that would be the door opening for a income tax on all of us in the state. That's what the critics believe the ultimate outcome is desired.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, excellent work as always, Hannah. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Seattle Morning News, Aaron Mason filling in for Dave Ross. 2 years ago this week, April 27th, 2019, one of Seattle's towering and ubiquitous construction cranes came crashing down in South Lake Union, and four people lost their lives. The question now, are people who live or work or drive under these cranes in Seattle any safer than they were 2 years ago? That's what Cairo 7 TV's Dave Wagner set out to investigate. Dave, thank you for joining us. And what did you find?
Aaron, good to talk to you today. You will recall, because I understand you were fairly close to this as well.
Yes.
It was just before 3:30 in the afternoon. There was a tremendous wind gust. I was actually across the street from this building. My wife and I were going to a storage unit that we have there right at the corner of Mercer and Fairview when there was just this tremendous, tremendous sound, and it was deafening, and soon we realized that a crane had fallen from the Google building. So for the past 2 years, I've been gathering the dozens of hours of police body cam video from the crane collapse. As you know, four people were killed, two people died in their cars, two iron workers died as well. Other people were injured, and the video is really sobering to watch. There are some things that are really interesting in this to see. Number one, it reveals the horror of that moment, but also the heroism of that day. Police were on scene very quickly, so were nearby doctors and nurses who came in to help the victims. But despite some really heroic efforts that you see on this body cam video, it was impossible to save the four people who died. They were so badly injured. Mm. The crane was so heavy that you could tell they died very, very quickly. So I was looking at this saying, what what are we doing differently now? Are we doing anything differently? So Seattle was the tower crane capital of the United States. It's now number two to Washington, D.C.
Really?
We have 43 tower cranes in the city right now. So in the body cam video, we see police questioning workers about what happened. And initially, one of the crew leaders, you hear them blaming the wind for blowing it off the building. What investigators would later learn is that workers did not follow manufacturer recommendations for dismantling the crane. Instead of removing the pins section by section, which is what's recommended by the manufacturer, they removed the pins all at once. And then when that big gust of wind came along, that left the crane vulnerable. So it fell off the building. And investigators say this was completely avoidable. An attorney for one of the survivors said this was an attempt by the companies in charge to save time and money.
Right.
So there was a state senator, Karen Kaiser. She introduced legislation here in Washington state to tighten restrictions for these crane companies. That legislation ended up failing, but she was able to get $300,000 additional dollars a year for crane inspectors, for additional crane inspectors. Those additional inspectors are assigned to King County, which is where most of the cranes are. And she believes now that there's a need for federal OSHA oversight to make sure these crane companies are following manufacturer guidelines nationwide, because we're seeing these crane accidents nationwide. They may not be exactly like we saw in Seattle, but there are clearly issues when they are assembling and disassembling cranes.
So this isn't an issue of bad protocol, you know, bad if you follow to the letter the steps you're supposed to take. But as we all know, in reality, you don't necessarily follow every step to the letter sometimes. So this is the solution that's being proposed, is to have people have oversight on site to make sure that people are doing things the way they're supposed to. Do you think that's a good solution to this issue?
I think it's a step toward a solution to this issue. I mean, I agree with you that, you know, we don't always follow for every single product that we get. We don't always follow everything. We don't follow every single step. But we're not in a situation where we're going to kill someone.
Right.
You know, if we don't follow those rules. This is a situation where these cranes are towering over the heads and cars of people in our community here. And, you know, when you're dealing with public safety, that's a different issue. There's a guy who was the Uber driver who was carrying three passengers on that day. His name is Ali Idris, and I talked to Ali. He was seriously injured in this accident. And there was a young woman in the backseat, 19-year-old woman, a student, who was killed. She was crushed by the crane. Her friend was sitting directly next to her. There was another person in the front seat, another passenger in the front seat. But we rode with him. He still has a lot of difficulty. The crane crushed his left side. Mm. And he's terrified when he drives in this city. He can't drive, but we rode in a car with him as he was a passenger. And he was looking up at the sky, and you can see him tremble. His hands are sweating. He is just terrified. And, you know, when a person is a victim of a crane accident, it's very difficult, according to Ali Idris's attorney, for people to go on, because cranes aren't supposed to just fall out of the sky.
Right.
And that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, very traumatic, I would imagine. Dave, when can we see this report that you've done?
It's going to be on tonight at 5:30 on Cairo 7. It's interesting, it's disturbing, and hopefully we can at least give people some idea of what happened that day, some of the solutions that have taken place, and what more needs to be done.
That is Cairo 7 TV's Dave Wagner. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. You can
ring my bell. Ring my bell, brought to you by Chevrolet Buick GMC of Puyallup. The supermoon was quite a sight earlier this week. It's beautiful. I love that moon. But Rachel Bell has her eye on something a little bit further away.
For many years, I've heard people mention some snafu in their life, or they say they're having a bad day, and then they just chuckle and matter-of-factly say, "What can you do? Mercury is in retrograde." I never understood what that meant, but I figured it had to do with astrology. And as someone who scores very low on the woo-woo scale, I never bothered to find out. But in February, two people delayed plans with me because of Mercury retrograde, and my curiosity finally got the best of me.
What it means is that it's the appearance from our vantage point on Earth that a planet appears to be going backwards in the opposite direction. Now, of course, planets, including Mercury, do not turn around.
Was this kind of an ancient optical illusion?
Yes.
That's Seattle astrologer Stephanie Gehling. She says there are three Mercury retrogrades every year, each one lasting about 3 weeks. And during these time periods, Stephanie says things relating to communication and technology often go awry.
Things that people avoid during Mercury retrograde would be signing an important contract, big, serious communications that might be binding. People like to not buy phones and computers. I mean, it's not a great time to launch something new if you can avoid it.
But done right, it shouldn't just be used as a period of avoidance.
Mercury retrograde is a really amazing time for re-editing, reviewing, reassessing. If you think about the fact that the planet appears to be traversing the path that it just moved through, that's what we should do. So we should go back over things that we have recently done in the realm of Mercury, in the realm of communication. Ooh, I had that sort of funky conversation with my brother. Let me go back over that and re-communicate.
Stephanie consults with many business leaders, including Chavi Home, co-owner of Seattle's Team Diva Real Estate.
We include astrology in our business. We just have a practice for ourselves and our team, which is the more you know about yourself, the better you're able to kind of show up and be successful.
Chavi says there was a Mercury retrograde in late 2019 that gave clues that 2020 would be a rocky year.
I was like, you know, this is an opportunity for us to prepare for what I know is going to be a massive pivot. I don't know what that pivot's going to look like, but I just need to like use this opportunity with Mercury and retrograde to like re-review personal relationships, re-review our shared finances so we can prepare for at that point, which I knew there was going to be a big transit in January of 2020.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson talked about Mercury retrograde on his show, Star Talk.
Astrology predates the methods and tools of science. So all of the astrological vocabulary and assertions trace to a time when Earth was the center of the known universe. People believe that these stars were like put there for our benefit. The foundations of astrology have no justification in a scientifically literate modern world. But people still cling to it. It's a way to offload accountability for random things that are happening in your life.
Jessica Butts disagrees.
If the moon can affect our oceans, then a planet can absolutely affect my itty-bitty existence in this world.
For the past decade, the psychotherapist turned entrepreneurial coach has used Mercury retrograde as a time to slow down and reflect. She noticed she was uncharacteristically lethargic and unmotivated during those periods of time.
I feel it, so I know it's not on the Myers-Briggs scale. Like, this is a whole nother conversation. You're a thinker and I'm a feeler.
Yeah.
And so you're looking for logic and practicality in things. And I am such a strong feeler that if my body tells me something's real, I don't need a book. I don't need to talk about it. Like, I believe it to be true.
Chavi also has no time for the haters.
I don't care what other people think like about how I do business because I have the checking account to prove that I do it the right way. I don't really talk about it to other people. I haven't been like, oh, by the way, I'm launching a business and the sun and Jupiter are going to be in relationship with each other. It's a complicated thing to explain to someone else.
The next Mercury retrograde will begin on May 29th.
Thank you, Rachel Bell. Miley Katie, where do you stand on this stuff?
I'm open to it.
Because you got a little woo-woo in you.
I've got a little woo-woo in me. Yeah, I'm anxious to see what the day holds because today, as we just heard from Rachel Bell, is retrograde.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, oh no, I'm quaking in my boots. I hope I don't sound judgmental. I happen to not believe any of that astrological stuff. But listen, there are crazy things that I believe are true. I don't hold anyone's beliefs against them. They're not out there hurting anybody. So if you wanna think that that it's not a good time to sign a contract because of what Mercury's up to, then God bless you. Have at it.
Yeah, it's a powerful force. I mean, I think it might be something like a ripple effect or even just a lot of people believing that it means something. So then people around you will change your reality.
Oh, look at you.
Oh,
Miley Katie, changing realities.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.